I am watching. That was the longest I ever, I think. I am watching WandaVision right now.
Hey, finally, let's go.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I'm not a big fan.
No?
The first two episodes I thought were super good. And then I think
Okay.
I just watched episode like six, and I thought that was the Halloween one. And they go trick-or-treating and Vision tries to escape and stuff. Sorry, spoilers, whatever. But
It's been out for a while. I think we're fine.
yeah, so I don't know, dude. Like I think like they've done some really creative things in the TV, like in the show. Like the sitcom style stuff and like the laugh tracks and like just the story in general has been super interesting. And but I just care so little about like all the sword stuff that's happening. I guess they have to include that for there to be a story, like, because
Yeah.
there has to be some force acting against Wanda. But no, dude, it's interesting. It's definitely like they're doing something different, and that's appreciated, I think. Like that's pretty cool. But yeah, just like I can't get over I don't know, the sword stuff's been kind of weird.
Yeah, it's like I don't know, they kind of had to do something there because Shield was obviously taken down in whatever movie that was, Winter Soldier,
I
I
don't
guess.
mean like I don't mean like I would rather it be Shield. I just mean showing stuff in the real world just boring.
I see what you mean.
I mean, but I definitely like I've laughed a few times out loud. Like there's been some funny stuff going on
I've
in the
LOL'd a few
actual.
times.
Yeah, just a couple times. I like how they brought in what's his face from X-Men franchise.
Yeah.
I don't remember the actor's name, but they
Evan Peters.
Evan Peters, okay.
I think that's
Yeah.
his name.
So that was funny. But yeah, it's interesting. It's and I think Paul Bettany as Vision, I think this is one of like the best Marvel performances I've seen.
Yeah, he's super good in it.
I think
I
he was yeah.
I've always been a big fan of Vision. Like, I would say he's probably one of my top three heroes.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think this series, especially I think maybe episode 8 that you may not have gotten to. There's like a really good scene in there with him and Wanda. And I think like he. I don't know, like throughout the MCU he's just been like there kind of, but this is like his time to shine and it's a really good character and
Yeah.
performed really
See,
well.
yeah, I agree. I think I've always really disliked him. I think like I've just had like kind of a bitter taste with him and Wanda, honestly, and I get the MCU Quicksilver because I just hated Age of Ultron. Like I think I remember that being the only Marvel movie I went to and like actually being disappointed. Because like I think I was so excited coming off of the first Avengers for the second one, and then I just did not like the second one. And like since then, Vision's been like, whatever. But this definitely has like brought him back a bit for me.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, again, Paul Bettany is like super good in it.
I gotta say, the first episode of Loki dropped last
Right,
week,
right.
and I like texted Michael. It is insanely good. Like, probably the best premiere out of the three shows so far, WandaVision, Falcon and Winter Soldier, and Loki, probably the best premiere. And
Gotcha.
it's like already so interesting. And I mean, kind of the same as Vision, like what I just said. Loki has always been that character that's like kind of off to the side and is always in the shadows of Thor or the Avengers or whatever. But it's really fascinating to see him on his own and kind of get that spotlight. So that's cool. Also, I gotta say, it looks like it's about to thunderstorm here in good old Ohio, and
Messing with the audio.
it's a little embarrassing, but sometimes the thunderstorms will knock out the Wi-Fi.
Okay, so we might just
So we might have two parts. I don't know. We'll see how
I'll try to
it
entertain them while you're gone.
goes.
Gosh, I meant to mention something about the audience, actually. Speaking of them, I don't know. I guess I'll just use this opportunity to say thank you for listening last week. I think you guys seem to enjoy the Ratatouille episode, so Thank you for the support.
Ratatouille episode popped off a little bit.
I think it was maybe the fastest. I think it was maybe like the fastest growth on an episode in the first like day.
Yeah.
Kind of shot up.
Probably
so
up there, yeah.
Maybe our Instagram promo helped. I'm not sure.
Maybe. Maybe we'll do another one. I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, guys, thank you so much for supporting. Aiden, anything else before we break for this ad?
Anything else? I don't think so. Episode 15 is crazy. Like, we're almost there.
I know, we're almost done.
And we've already started discussing season 5, which is crazy. Honestly, like, just saying that out loud is so crazy. But we've been discussing a little bit and what we kind of want to do. So I'm sure that we're going to take a little break between 4 and 5. But again, we thank you for the support and for our odd weeks that we've had here as of late. But we were back and we were finishing strong. And yeah.
And I guess quickly, we are going to continue with our structure up until episode 20. We're going to have a guest in episode 20 that will come out. That'll be revealed in the coming weeks. And then we're going to have an episode 21, which is going to be, we haven't really talked about it that much, but here's my plan. And Aiden, chime in. I think we're going to rank all 20 movies either in order of what is our favorite or what we think is best, or both. We could do both, actually, because I'm sure it won't take that long. And then I think we're going to do the Oscar categories for the movies we've watched.
Yeah, going to have a little award ceremony.
And I think how we'll do it as well is, like, we'll make ourselves nominate. So let's say, like, for Best Picture, we can only do 10. And we can say, like, if we want to, we can say the honorable mentions, or, like, we can say, like, which ones are nominated. We don't have to. Especially in, like, a format like this, it's, like, 18 of the movies probably could be nominated for Best Picture. Yep. So it's, like, redundant to actually nominate them. So we'll just play it by ear.
Yep. And like Michael said, it'll probably be a pretty short episode, just a little fun ending to season 4. And a little thank you to everyone. So,
yeah. But with that, let's break for an ad real quick, and we'll be right back with La La Land.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. I did want to say, starting off, I rented this film on Amazon Prime, and on Amazon Prime, it gives you the little, like, fun facts off to the side. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the Amazon X-ray.
Yes. And I realized that this is the film that caused the chaos at the Oscars in 2017, I guess, where they were reading out Best Picture, and I guess the envelope that was given to the people was the Emma Stone, like, Best Actress envelope, and so they were, like, confused, so they just said La La Land, and then...
Is that what happened?
Because I was reading about it, like, before the episode, because I was curious, and it seems like they handed him the wrong envelope, and he saw, like, there were two people, and the guy was, like, confused. Like, he kept, like, looking inside the envelope and, like, double-checking and flipping over the paper, and then he just, like, looked at the lady that he was up there with, and then the lady just grabbed the envelope and was like, La La Land, and...
Ugh. Trying to help didn't help.
And then, you know, the whole La La Land team comes up, and apparently the director...
Damien Chazelle.
Yeah. He, like, grabs the real thing and steps up to the mic and is like, yo, like...
It wasn't him that did it. I think it was a producer. Okay. No, yeah. But I remember. Someone else. I remember it wasn't Damien Chazelle. I think it was a producer.
Someone else.
Went up there and was like... Stepped up. Was actually Moonlight won. Yeah. Sorry, Barry Jenkins.
Yeah. So that was a little bad. Chaos that happened. Fun fact. And Jimmy Kimmel was just like, had no idea what to do. Good times.
That's awful. I think that's like the only time that's ever happened.
Probably.
For Best Picture, no less. They couldn't have it on like a sound editor or set designer or anything like that. It had to be a Best Picture.
Yeah. And also found out that La La Land won Best Cinematography and was the first film to be shot entirely on film, to win the award since 2010 when Inception won Best Cinematography. So there's a little fun fact.
This was shot on film and digital.
Okay, sorry.
This was shot using both. I think Amazon's wrong, actually.
SMH, Amazon's lying to me? They're just making me look like a fool out
here.
All
the way since Inception. Wait, so Inception won what?
Best Cinematography in 2010, I believe.
Interesting, I did not know that. And that was shot, yeah, entirely on film, because Nolan really likes film. The cinematography was really good in this movie.
It was very good.
Very
yeah.
pretty.
Yeah.
Very cool for yeah. lots of reasons.
Yeah. La La Land is one of my favorites, I would say. And I actually took quite a bit of notes, just because I don't know, I've always watched it as a like the way that you're supposed to, like is this romance film and this musical or whatever. And this is the first time I've actually like sat down and purposefully watched and listened to stuff to take notes on it. So it's interesting to have that experience. But overall, I mean, to me, it was just as good as any other time I've watched mm-hmm. it. Super good. And some of the biggest things that I noticed, you know, just like we just said, cinematography, super, super incredible. And I wrote down a note. I said something like, I said, I haven't been paying attention too much, but it feels like all the musical/dance sections are all one long shot. And it is a really smooth feeling to it. Which is fascinating because like almost none of the other scenes, it's just like strictly the musical and dancing that I noticed. Right out the gate, the colors are super beautiful, very, very vibrant and saturated, and a big feature. And also the lack of light, was a big part of the film. Just like anytime someone had a monologue or a solo in a song or something, like all the light in the room faded out except for this one spotlight on the character. Super interesting. I'll let you hop in here if you have anything.
Yeah, totally. I agree with all those things. I think the cinematographer was Linus Sandgren, who hasn't done a ton of stuff. He did First Man, which is a non-musical that Damien Chazelle did. It's his most recent movie. He's coming out with one, but it was after Whiplash and La La Land. But it's really beautiful. It's lots of wide, lots of 35mm lens. I think it was primarily shot on that. And I think, man, there's some beautiful lens stuff done. There's a lot of, it's shot anamorphic. Have we talked about anamorphic on here?
Don't believe so.
So how anamorphic works is you have a lens who's as if the lens is a person. A lens has elements in it, which are the pieces of glass. They're called elements. And so the elements in an anamorphic lens are oval instead of round. So the typical kit lens you get with your Canon that are like free with the camera are, it's not like, there are good lenses as well with round elements, but your typical lens is going to have circle elements, and that's called a spherical lens. But then you have an anamorphic lens with oval elements, and what that does is it compresses your picture, stretching it in a way vertically. So your image ends up like morphed vertically. And so what you do is you capture that image on a negative, and it's stretched vertically, and then you stretch it back out. And what that does is it not only gives you widescreen, but it just changes the look of everything.
Yeah.
Anamorphic lenses, you get a lot of anamorphic flares, and that's those flares, like lines you see a lot in La La Land that stretch all the way across the screen. You don't get that unless you have an anamorphic lens.
Mm-hmm.
You also get oval-shaped bokeh in the background of your shots, and that's like just a really pretty oblong bokeh as opposed to circular bokeh from a spherical lens. You see a lot of movies faking anamorphic. You see movies that don't have these baked-in looks that an anamorphic lens gives you, but they just slap black bars in the top and bottom and then put stripes across the screen. You see that in a lot of movies. But this was, like, all natural. And what I found most interesting was this natural vignette of, I think, was specific to these lenses, because that's not all anamorphic lenses give you this. It's like these in the corners of the screen for throughout almost the entire movie, there's these like flares when they get into certain angles of the sun that cover the corners, and then sometimes I think they just vignette it, and it, whether they're using a matte box, I have no idea what they use, but it cuts off the corners in black. And there's one shot that stood out. Well, there's like I guess a good shot to look at this for is when Seb is sitting at the piano playing Over the Record at the beginning mm-hmm. of the movie mm-hmm. and it's a 35 shot, and it's got this beautiful like vignette flare. It's really cool. And then another shot is when he picks up Mia, and there's the cameras across the street from Mia's parents' house, and it's just like all the corners are vignette and black, and it like looks like a film a film negative. And it's like, it just really brings out like a classic film look that and even a lot of anamorphic movies you watch don't have that look. So the cinematography was super interesting. And then I'll be quick about this, but you mentioned like the long shots, and yeah, it happened mostly during dance numbers. And I think there's always like I think with most performance work in film, especially when you're bringing something from like a Broadway stage to film, it's like Les Mis in 2012, they made a point to do like an extreme close-up in all of their shots so that you could see Hugh Jackman and Anne Hathaway singing. You know, it's like, we're going to prove to you that they're singing. And that's what they did in this movie at Fools Who Dream with them at the end. That was all on set. Emma Stone singing that. But the long take is kind of a means to show, like, look at them dancing. They're actually dancing this whole time. And you'll see, you know, and I think they do it a lot better in this movie than they do in old movies. But a lot of old musicals, you know, there will be a random cut in the middle of a dance number because they couldn't do the dance number all in one go, which is understandable. But, like, the long takes really emphasize, like, a continuation of movement and continuation of dance. One of the most impressive ones for me was the long take at the party Someone in the Crowd, where you have this camera shot that's really long, and then all of a sudden the camera's in the pool mm-hmm. when the guy jumps off the balcony. And so it's like, you don't really acknowledge that, like, this was the camera they were using, walking around with on a steady cam, I imagine. Then suddenly the camera's in the pool, and it continues to be in the pool. It goes from underwater mm-hmm. to above water to underwater to above water, spins yeah. around, ends on a shot of the fireworks. And it's just like, wow, that so much just happened there. I don't mm-hmm. know if there was a hidden cut that allowed the camera to go in the pool. Probably there were several hidden cuts during those long takes. And again, nowadays you're able to hide that a lot better than you were during Singing in the Rain, for instance. But mm-hmm. Yeah, super impressive cinematography work, without a doubt.
Yeah. Oh. Sorry, go ahead.
Just one last thing, you mentioned the color. They did this really interesting thing where the color was obviously pretty unrealistic, like it's supposed to be. But it was really well done. They did this cool thing I noticed a couple times where, first, when Mia is standing outside of J.K. Simmons's restaurant mm-hmm. where Sebastian's playing, and when they first brush shoulders, and she's standing in front of two red lights. Mm-hmm. And they do this thing, it's like when you overexpose an image, it doesn't look good. Like, an overexposed image looks bad. I was just watching Casino Royale, and they like intentionally overexpose an image when James Bond's drugged at the poker table, and then they overexpose another scene at the beginning of two guys fighting in the background, like to make it grittier. But what they do in this movie is they overexpose bits of the image that are in color. And so you have like red shining on Mia's face, and it's just, I think, slightly overexposed, it looks like. And it's like this saturated, like void on her face and in her hair. And it's like really cool. It's like, if you overexpose a natural image, it doesn't look good. But if you throw color on it and overexpose it, it like it does something different. And I think that was, I've never seen that before. Never, at least never noticed it. I'm sure I've seen it, but awesome. It was awesome. And then so much about the cinematography. You mentioned the lights, like, was so good when he's playing at the dinner scene and at Seb's, and at the end when this all the lights shut down and the spotlight shines on him, you know, it's like, I think it didn't feel all like a special effect. It literally was turning off the lights on set. It was literally turning off all the lamps and the candles that were at the tables,
yeah,
and letting an actual real spotlight shine on him. And like, that was the same with Fools Who Dream, where she's giving her audition and all the lights turn off and there's one spotlight on her, and it feels so real and so practical. And I think that leads into like this movie's relationship with Hollywood and with the history of Hollywood, and I'll get into that later, but yeah, that was really well done.
Yeah, you pointed out a few things I was going to say. That I was going to mention the scene in front of the J.K. Simmons place, where, like, I don't know, in like any, I get like any student film or something that I would watch, I'd be like, wow, that just looks terrible. Like the red, the neon red light that is blasting on her hair is just like it looks super grainy and is like borderline a little too much light. But I think, like, just from what we've seen in the film so far, like, obviously we know, like, Mia's in the bathroom and there's like this random pink light just shining on her, and like so many other, you know, scenarios where that happens. And so we understand that color is a huge thing. And then I think one thing on the cinematography, the scene where they are in the like movie studio area, like the fake town or whatever, together,
right?
I noticed during that scene, like, that's the point where I noticed, I was like, wow, the cinematography is really unique. Because I don't know, you watch so many movies and you kind of, like, you can kind of anticipate what the shots are going to be, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it felt like every shot that was in that scene was something that I was not expecting.
Sure, right.
For example, they're just walking around and they come up to the studio that has the doors open, and it shows them from, like, the top of a corner of a building, and you can barely see it. It's like on the third, like just in the building. And they're just these small, tiny figures that are on the ground. And then the next one cuts and you can see inside the building good, but it's just a wide shot. Like, you would normally expect a close up on a few guys working on a camera or some people rehearsing lines or whatever. And then it cuts back out to them, and you'd expect a close-up or, like, a side shot or something like that. And it's just this wide-angle shot. And while it seems, like, a little plain because it's just a wide shot, at the same time, it's, like, really awesome and really cool. Yeah, no,
absolutely.
And another thing I wanted to point out, the opening scene is just awesome. I pointed out the mixing of music between cars, like right out the gate before the musical number starts. Like, the camera just kind of moves back on the road, and there's these mixing and mashing of songs, different songs from different people's cars. Every car is a different color. Every person has a different color shirt or piece of clothing on or whatever. And I don't know, like, right out the gate, I got the impression that it's highlighting how people are different and how, like, people are allowed to be different, if that makes sense. And, and I think it was a fascinating tie into where we don't meet the main characters in that main sequence, like you would expect to. And I don't know, after that's over and you see all this color and all this dancing and all these different people, and you cut back to Seb's car and he keeps rewinding a tape because he has to get it at, like, just the right spot or whatever. And then he pulls around and Mia is there and she's rehearsing, and it's like right out the gate, we have met these people already. And if that makes sense, I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling.
Well, I think it's, Yeah, no, I was gonna say two of the exact same things. I do like the opening dance number, Another Day of Sun. It's cool, it's creative, but like I think it's significant that you don't meet the characters, and it's like not the main character
Yeah.
giving this dance number. It's a bunch of random people on the
Right.
highway, and it's talking about coming to LA and like taking your shot and like following your dream. That's what the song's about, but it's spoken through a bunch of other people in LA that are, going through the same thing potentially that Mia and Sebastian are going through. And so I think that was just great. Off the top of my head, I can't think of another musical that does this. I'm sure that this is some sort of known practice in musicals, but yeah, I think that was a really creative approach, and I love the introduction of the characters. I think that it's so interesting that you have a tracking shot up above Sebastian's car. You find out a lot about his character, and this is just such good visual storytelling. It's,
Yeah.
he's sitting there. You don't see his face, just behind his head, but it's Ryan Gosling. You're there to see Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone in a musical, and you see his head, and he's rewinding a tape over and over because he's practicing it and memorizing it and just trying to ingrain that. And you then the shot I was talking about earlier, when he's playing piano, he's playing that same part of the song. And so you find out a lot about his obsession with jazz and just in general, and his just obsessive attitude right from that very first shot. And then you find out a lot about Emma Stone and her shot, and just she's a little bit more scattered, and like a bit more easygoing than he is, and I remember watching that, and I remember thinking immediately, like, this is just going to be an interesting storytelling because of the way that they introduce Ryan Gosling, and then he leaves, and you don't see him again until it rewinds and it's back to him in that scenario. So,
Yeah.
yeah, great character introduction.
I think that even the character introduction goes even further into, I would say, up until the like the pool party scene where Ryan Gosling is playing "Take on Me"
Yeah.
on the, what is that instrument? The
I have no
electric
idea.
piano guitar thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. But I just like up until that point, you see Ryan Gosling as this extremely stubborn and stuck up guy that is just obsessed with music, and you can see that with his interaction with his, I think it's his sister that comes to his apartment, and just how like set he is on what he's gonna do, and like he hasn't unpacked the boxes because he's just gonna open his music club, so what's the point in wasting the time? And he won't let his sister sit on that stool because it's this piece of jazz history, and you find out how dedicated, I guess, he is
Yeah.
to the genre of jazz and to
Absolutely.
what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
And you can
I
see, sorry, go ahead.
go ahead, go ahead. Go ahead, no, you're good.
can Zoom, it's getting to us. Emma Stone, you can see she's this easygoing character, but also I noticed at the pool party she was being kind of stubborn and stuck up in her own way.
Sure.
When she requests the song, I forget what song it is,
I ran.
that Ryan Gosling is just so, like he can't believe that she would
Yeah.
insult him like that. Like right there, you can see the chemistry is, starting to warm up a little bit, and super
A
cool to
Flock
see.
of Seagulls is the name of the band that sings "I Ran," just by the way.
Just the two characters like warming up to each other, I guess, and super, I don't know, they were like separated up until that point, so it was a cool, I guess, introduction to the both of them, really.
That first 10 minutes, that's like up until someone in the crowd, there's so little expository dialogue. There's like there are words. There's certainly words. She does auditions, she's at the coffee shop, but there's nothing that conveys any sort of story that you often see in the first 10 minutes of a movie. But instead, it's just showing the activities, the day-to-day of these characters, and like so easily, like in the same way that first shot tells you a lot about Sebastian's character. And that first shot of Mia practicing an audition in her car, then going to the audition after spilling coffee on herself, like that whole exchange of scenes tells so much about these two characters. It tells everything you need to know. Mm-hmm. Then again, you rewind back to Ryan Gosling and you know, sorry about that honking outside. You rewind back to Ryan Gosling and then you see him go through the same motions. And there's a little bit more exposition there when he's talking to his sister, especially, but it's the same thing, like really good, super, visual storytelling again.
Yeah. Just want to say real quick, I apologize. I think my mic is picking up some of this rain because it is coming down hard.
I can't hear it on my end.
Oh, perfect. All right. Well, hopefully no one else does either.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if you have anything else to add to what you're saying.
I don't know. I don't know. I can move on to something else unless you're moving on to something else.
Yeah, I was going to move on to something else.
Well, I'll say this real quick, because this is a little note I have right here that I guess talking about that first scene, it was very funny. It's very comedic, and it kind of makes me smile every time when Winter flashes up on the screen. Mm-hmm. During, like, everyone's in short sleeves.
Yeah.
And, like, it's super sunny outside, and then Winter comes up on the screen. Mm-hmm. And I would argue, bringing up the Endgame episode, this is a useful use of title cards and captions on the screen, because without them, you wouldn't be able to tell time is passing, which is part of the joke, because like all four seasons in LA are the same.
Yeah.
And in most movies, I think you would use visuals to convey that. You'd show snow, you'd show leaves, you'd mm-hmm. show flowers, and then you'd show a pool party to show the four seasons.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, they used captions. And I don't know, man, I think at the end of this movie, you get a, just like the Avengers, you get a 5 years later caption. And
I would argue with that one.
I was going to say, no, I'm okay with, I was okay with 5 years later in Endgame.
All right.
I would say this was a more effective 5 years later than Endgame.
Okay. All right.
But,
you and the Endgame title cards, feeling,
I don't know, man. No, I'm saying these ones were good. So good job on Damian. And the crew for making some good title cards. It's not easy to do. So good job.
Yeah, I want to talk about the soundtrack. Absolutely incredible soundtrack. I was thinking about it before we're hitting record. I am like such a huge movie soundtrack nerd. Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, like like I'm sure that you can agree with me. You listen to or you watch films and you're like, wow, that soundtrack is really good. But I feel like I always take it a step further and I like add it to an Apple playlist and I'll like mm-hmm. listen to it while I'm driving or walking down the street or something. And people would think that I'm probably weird or something. But
no. I mean, this certainly is one that like is worthy of that.
Right. Yeah. And I think. I would say one of my favorites is probably City of Stars. Very, very good song.
Sure, absolutely.
But I think, I don't know if we touched on it for Singing in the Rain or not, but I think it's kind of similar to that where the soundtrack is good in both of them. Soundtrack's great in both of them. And the film is great, but the film would not be as great if it weren't for the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Like La La Land is a great movie, but if the soundtrack wasn't as good as it is, I don't think that the film would be as good as it is.
No, definitely not. It's like I've seen musicals where it's like, yeah, the dancing's good, but you know, these songs are not memorable. These songs are not songs that I really want to listen to. It's like mm-hmm. I feel as if in Singing in the Rain and in La La Land, probably more La La Land because it's more contemporary. It's like both have songs that I would and have played in the car or just mm-hmm. have played or looked up on YouTube because I want to listen or watch them. And mm-hmm. and I can't say that about every musical because not every musical, I mean, yeah, totally true. If the song's not good, then
yeah,
it takes away a lot.
Definitely. Honestly, I think that's all I had on the soundtrack.
No, you're
part,
good.
So if you...
comparing it to Singing in the Rain, I think, yeah, it. I guess this is a big point, but well, first of all, there's some clear influence from Singing in the Rain and mm-hmm. other older musicals. He literally swings on a lamppost
mm-hmm.
in that yeah. one shot,
yep.
which was obviously a reference to Singing in the Rain. And there was also during someone in the crowd that gets the party, and there's like the superimposed images of like champagne being poured.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought me back to Singing in the Rain during the talking pictures montage just before the Beautiful Girls number, when it's like just like crazy, all these different people. There's like the toy soldiers and the guy with the megaphone and like all these different things being superimposed and cheerleaders and stuff like that. And it was very reminiscent of that for me. And that's not something you see in a lot of modern movies, because it was kind of an effect you did see a lot in older movies. Mm-hmm. Because I think superimposed images in older movies was like a big deal. And it was like, wow, cool.
Yeah.
But you don't see that all the time in new movies. And so it was done so well, because everything... This movie, I think what I would walk away from it thinking is like, man, I have a lot of big points I'm about to make. Like, I have back-to-back-to-back-to-back big points.
Lay it on me, man.
So, this movie, is just characterized by using traditions that work so well in old movies, but polishing them so much. It's like old movies, it's like, we were able to talk about Dial-M for Murder and say that it was great, but we're like, wow, that green screen looked janky.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so there's something great about seeing the traditions of an old musical brought back and done with perfection, because mm-hmm. we're to the point now when you can do things with perfection,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in 20 years, it's not going to look like perfection, but mm-hmm. you know, right now it does. And it's cool to see a movie that uses practicals. We already talked about the practical lighting, how instead of using like effects, you know, surely there was some change in coloration, exposure and whatnot, but they turn off all the lamps in the room to like make sure the lights are just on Ryan Gosling or Emma Stone. And like, that's cool. That's practical lighting. And then you have the sequence at the end during like the what if sequence with a big dance number mm-hmm. of, you know, them going through all these, like going to Paris and having the set. That was a callback to American in Paris. Those like cutouts of Paris and like just the way that set looked. Like there are a lot of old musicals that look like that, but like American in Paris made that famous, also starring Gene Kelly from Singing in the Rain. And it's like such a active decision to make it look like that. And there's the part where it zooms up on a globe and the globe moves and mm-hmm. the airplane goes to Paris. It's like, you could do that digitally
mm-hmm.
and you could do it digitally, perfectly digitally, and make it look however you want digitally. And it would look great, but instead use a real globe like they would have.
Mm-hmm.
And it like that was cool to see. And I love that one of the coolest parts for me is there's the awesome dance number in the planetarium. Is that what you call it? The
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, like the stargazing. And they're up. And
the observatory.
Observatory, that's right. And they're dancing in the stars, dancing with the stars, if you will. And it's clearly CGI, obviously, special effects using there. But then you come back later. Yeah. But then later,
bad joke. I'm sorry.
You have them dancing in that dome of lights, and there's water on the ground that reflects the lights, and so it's as if they're dancing amongst the stars again, but this time it's done practically, as you probably would have seen it done 70 years ago. So I think callbacks to Hollywood and just like using practicals. I mean, man, using practicals is always better. I think like it's what makes the Dark Knight trilogy stand out amongst superhero movies. It's using practicals is I think the way to go, but that's just one of the takeaways I had.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was gonna say just in general, there's a lot of like callback sequences in the film, or a lot of repeating themes, I guess. One that we mentioned already, Ryan Gosling in his car rewinding the tape, and that song that's on the tape is the one that he's practicing and trying to memorize. Mm-hmm. And another big one is when Emma Stone walks into the same coffee shop she worked in, and she's the one that's famous and not the one that's, you know, behind the counter being starstruck or whatever. And just super fascinating callbacks that are a little, like, just a little twisted, that kind of involve our characters in different ways, which is interesting. One question I had for you that I could not figure out myself. There was this other couple in the film. I think the names were Laura and Jordan, I think. Mm-hmm. Where, like, we see them with Mia and Sebastian, and the couple is engaged, and they're, like, checking out the ring. And then later on, Sebastian plays the piano at their party. And then, like, 5 years later, we see, like,
a picture of them.
A Merry Christmas card with a kid, yeah. And I was wondering, do you have any idea what this couple, like, who they are and what they mean to the
story? That was his sister who talked to him in his house.
Really?
On a stool. Yeah.
What the heck? I didn't even notice.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't really see her face that much in the first scene. But yeah, that's his sister. I'm almost certain that's
her. Well, all right. Well, do you know why? Like, do you know why it was kind of, I don't know, like, obviously it played kind of a big part in the film since it was coming up so often?
It's the thing, and that's fascinating about this movie, is, like, this movie only has Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling in it. Every
and
other character,
J.K. Simmons. I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, he's in two scenes. John Legend's in, like, three scenes. Like, this movie, you don't see that many blockbuster, huge budget movies with, like, two characters in it. Mm-hmm. Because I think so often, and I go through this with my writing, where it's like, oh, I need someone to do this, let me add a character. And it's like, and that's easy to do, but I don't think it makes your story stronger. And there's the flip side, where it's like you have Wes Anderson and the Coen brothers, who have huge ensemble casts. Mostly Wes Anderson's like the king of that, and it's awesome. It's great. It's so fun to watch. But you also can get lazy, I think, with characters. But this movie centers completely around just Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. I think that's so cool. But it's also cool that, like, they throw in, you know, a character like his sister, who you're just going to see twice throughout it, and it's like random, like, oh, she's married, they're still involved in their life, like, and, oh, they had a kid, and they don't linger on these characters too long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't make it a point to have her parents, when she goes and visits home, try to teach her a lesson. You don't need that. You don't need the sister to say again what she already said to Sebastian. She's already said that, and I think it's special. I think the character work is super special. Not only, like, the main character's development, but just, like, the fact that it's just them in it. And the fact that they have these characters walking around them that are a big part of the story, but they never go over what Greg and Mia's breakup's like, because you don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to see it. And I just think that's so cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about, like, the actual romance aspect of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it is obviously a very large part of the film. And I think one of the big notes that I made, sorry, excuse me while I flip back and forth between pages. The film is a romance film. And
correct.
You know, it's also a musical. It's also, you know, a little bit of comedy. Yes, fact, it is a romance film.
That's a romance. Good job.
But it's like, it's about the romance, but it's also about what it takes to be an artist, or what it takes to pursue your passions. And I think the best part about the film is that it is a romance, but it's real. Like, the epilogue, I think, is the official term for it, where Sebastian's playing the theme on the piano in his club, and we kind of see a what if. And it's a scene of what Mia and Sebastian longed for together. Like, obviously, you know, these characters said that they would always love each other, and, you know, you think that they would want to spend the rest of their lives together. But it's, you know, life gets in the way, whatever, and there's shifting priorities, etc. So that ending scene is what Sebastian and Mia longed for, but it's also what the audience longed for. Like, you walk into a romance film and you expect it to be a classic Hollywood romance where these characters meet each other and everything works out, blah, 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 the end, happy ending. But I think the real aspect of it, like the realness of it, is what makes the ending so great for me personally. Another thing I picked up on, there's obviously a shift in the relationship whenever Sebastian starts going on tour. And I noticed that whenever the relationship between them starts to fade a little bit, the musical numbers and the dancing and all that jazz. Ha, jazz.
It sounded like that pun was intended.
Honestly, it was not intended, but all that stuff, it fades as well, which is interesting. That the movie is kind of driven by that in the beginning, and then once the relationship starts to fade, then all of that starts to fade as well. Another thing, whenever Sebastian comes back and surprises Mia with dinner at their place, you can see that Mia is actually like very bothered by the fact that Sebastian is okay playing the music that he, you know, wasn't obsessed with. You know, like, he was obsessed with this traditional jazz, and now he's off playing some, like, way
something
too,
bad. Let's just say it. I don't like John Legend.
I wrote that down. I was like, John Legend feels weird in this movie. I mean, even in that scene, that sense of Mia actually being upset about it, I don't know. I feel like a partner would be like, okay, if this is what you want to do, then, you know, I'll support you in that. And if you want to tour and play bad music, then that's fine. And we'll go forward with that. But Mia's actually stuck up and hung up on the fact that he's not doing what he wanted to do, which is, you know, open a club and have this traditional jazz that people come to. And that's like the main part of the club. And it's not this background music or whatever. And even though it doesn't, like, there's no explicit part of the scene that says that's, you know, one of the factors in them, like, the relationship kind of drifting away from one another, like, you can still pick up on that. And I think that scene was executed really well. Sorry, I'm going on. I don't know if you have anything.
No, I think you're right about the music. The music plays a really, you can have a musical. I think Singing in the Rain makes the music the forefront of the story, and you know, the musical is what saves Singing in the Rain. It's what saves them, is making their new movie a musical and saving it. I think the music, thematically fits so well in this movie too. Like, she's at dinner with Greg, and then Greg's brother, and she's just not into the conversation. It's, like, boring or whatever, and she looks up at the speaker and hears the music, the jazz, or not even the jazz, just, like, Sebastian's theme playing. And she leaves and goes to the theater with Sebastian. And same with the photo shoot. You have the photo shoot when he is told to play piano, and he plays that song again, and he leaves and tries to go to the movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the there's that thread throughout the story that I think is really strong, and it comes through, and it works every time. I don't know that I agree with you about Mia and her opinion with Sebastian. Yes, I think she's concerned. She's like, "Do you want to do this? Like, do you like this music? Why are you playing it if you don't like it?" I think those are just questions she's asking. I don't think she literally has a problem with him touring. I really don't. And I think that I don't think she has a problem with him touring with Keith or playing music that he doesn't love, I think she wants to bring that up because it's a problem if that's ruining his life. Like, if that's what's not making him happy, then she's just bringing that up, like, hey, this isn't what you wanted to do, just making right. sure. I don't think that she was actually bitter in any way about that. I think what she was a bit upset about in that scene was he was asking her to give up, to put the theater and her one-woman show on the back burner and come with him. And that attitude is flipped eventually in the movie. But, yeah, I think that's what she was more concerned about. And I think you're right. There was concern about him not doing what he loves. But I don't really think that him touring bothered her that much. But besides the fact that she missed him, and I think that's natural. But,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think... No, I agree with you. I think that scene alone just had a lot of different moving themes, and I think I slightly disagree with you about her having a problem about him touring. Like, she seemed to be surprised that he was in it for the long haul, I guess. That
right. Yeah, that's right.
He was gonna be on tour for a few months and then come back, record make a record, and then go on tour again. And I think she was troubled by that in a manner of which that he was going to keep doing that and not do the club or do the thing that he always wanted to do.
Right. It was being in it for the long haul and that not being what he loves. Right.
Yeah. So,
yeah, right. I know what you mean. Yeah. Are you continuing, or do you want me to say something?
No, you got it. I feel like I've pretty much said what everything that I'd like
gotcha.
To say.
Gotcha. So. Well, I'm about halfway through my stuff. Sorry, I took a lot of notes, dude. I'll make it quick. Don't worry.
I'll chime in here and there.
Yeah, for sure. I loved One Shot. Right after the fight, I guess we'll talk about this since we're on it. Right after the fight. The only, like, I said that it's, like, easy to make things not easy, but, like, it's more possible to make things perfect as opposed to old movies. So this whole movie is, like, locked off, perfect. Everything seems to be in its place until the fight scene, and it goes handheld. For the first time in the movie, I think, it's handheld following around Sebastian as he gets his burnt food out of the oven, and Mia, she walks out the door and slams it.
Good observation there, Michael.
Same deal with Lady Bird, if you remember, when she walks in on Lucas Hedges in the bathroom. Same exact thing. Only in Lady Bird, it was from a place of it being more of a low-budget production, it felt, and everything being locked off and simple. And this doing crazy things with the camera at times and being very extravagant with the camera and yet still just perfect and so methodical. I guess is the right word. So yeah, that was cool. Yeah, another like cool practical moment. Again, like, I'm just hooked up on the practicals because it makes the movie so much better. Like, if you can do something practically, meaning you can do it for real with props or makeup or
mm-hmm.
special effects on set, it's always better than CGI.
Mm-hmm.
100% of the time, I think. The pan back and forth between Sebastian and Mia while she's dancing, and this is like kind of a clip that went on Instagram. It was going around of like the camera.
I've seen it way too many times.
I've seen it so many times, but I think it's interesting that the camera actually whips back and forth between mm-hmm. these two. And they made a point to put lights between the two actors so that while it's panning and whipping around, it sees something. It doesn't just go to black and then another character. It sees lights and people sitting there.
Yeah.
That shot, the last time it whips, also comes off of a locked tripod shot and starts to back up and show the rest of the club. And I guess that's spliced together with a shot that they did specially where they were going to move with it. And it wasn't like the same setup as the whipping shots, the whip pans. So that was just, I think, good filmmaking and very interesting.
It's so crazy that, like, they're able to do that. Like, I don't know. It just from coming from, like, just thinking about trying to do that, just having a this super quick whip pan. Is that the correct term? Whip pan?
Yeah, whip pan.
Yeah. And just straight up transitioning to like an entirely different camera setup and have it like flawlessly cut. I don't recall if that actually happened, but just you saying that, I thought about it. It's just incredible that that's able to happen. And
I don't think it's that, I don't want to say it's not difficult, because it's difficult to make it look perfect, but it's just smart the way they do it. You know, they have this whip pan setup where they have a guy whipping back and forth between them, and then they have one take where they just whip straight to Ryan Gosling and have this operator walk backwards and show the rest of the scene. It is a lot of work goes into it to make it look perfect and to make it look good, and that's a lot of pre-production work to plan it out.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take a step back and say, how do we do this practically and not rely on editing and special effects after the fact, I think that like there's so many elements. You know, you can do this at home with a camera where you can whip your camera and do the same thing that they did. And a digital looks different than film in this regard, because you get some distortion with digital sensors, especially cheaper digital sensors. And that's just the way that the digital sensor processes an image. It gets wobbly when you move it, but that's something you have to take into account. But it's possible. It's like you can do these things if you think about them practically. And like that's, I think, what's so exciting about filmmaking is like, you look at this and think, wow, that's awesome. Okay, let's break that down and actually think about how they do it. And like, I could literally do that at home, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool. Again, I'm not saying I could do that at home and it not make it look like it did in this movie, but you know what I mean. There were a lot of quiet introspective moments I loved. One of them was Mia sitting at the table with Greg and then listening to the music and then leaving. I thought that was great. I loved Sebastian sitting on his bed listening to Mia on the phone with her parents, and she's talking about how, oh, he's saving up money, he's gonna get the club, and it's clearly their parents are asking questions about like, does he have any money, are you sure he's gonna, you know, start the club, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And Sebastian's sitting there and he looks at a stain in his ceiling, like a leak stain in his ceiling, and like that's enough to tell you what he's going through, what he's thinking in that moment. And that then is enough to motivate him going and accepting Keith's offer for the band. Mm-hmm. And you never question it. You never question, would he really go, you know, sign those papers and become a part of that band he doesn't want to be in? Because it's so clear that the conversation that Mia had with her parents that he overheard was enough of a motivation for him to do that. And I think it's really hard to find motivation for characters to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Not only to find it, but to make it feel natural. And I think it does both of them in a matter of 30 seconds on screen without any words from that character, just from mm-hmm. him listening to someone else. And you don't even hear the parents. You only hear Mia.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was really great. There was a shot of John Legend where he has microphone stands behind him. And that creaky door there. There's a shot of John Legend where he has microphone stands in the background, and they're shaped in such a way that frame his head. It's like, that's just good art direction and production design. I said movie's pretty light for the most part, so the lows, like the bad parts, hit really hard. It's like you don't really have that bad of a moment until like the fight when she leaves. And I think it's another like moment I love, and just no dialogue, just showing things, is like so carefully crafted. All these scenes where there's not even dialogue needed. She gets out of her bad audition where they don't say anything. They just say, thank you, we're done. She leaves, and she's clearly in a bad mood, but she passes by the movie theater and remembers that she has a date with Ryan Gosling, and she suddenly smiles, and it's like, everything's okay. And you didn't need words for it. You just had to, it showed her face looking outside at the movie theater as she passed. And it's like, wow, that is good storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So impressive. Sebastian was a really good boyfriend. At the end of the movie, when he wanted her to follow her dream, even though it meant losing each other. That was a good boyfriend move.
I'll also say, I really wish that I could have the style of Sebastian in this film and be able to
I remember
to
watching
it off.
For the like that's I remember watching very, it the first time and wanting his small rectangular watch. I remember looking online for hours like for this specific watch. Yeah, impactful movie, but good boyfriend. And then, you know, there's the switch there, because at the dinner table when they're fighting, he doesn't want, he wants her to, you know, not literally give up her dream, but he wants to put her play on a back burner and follow him. And the switch occurs where suddenly she has this once in a lifetime opportunity and is her dream. That's the difference. And that you're right. That's the difference that Mia was concerned about, was like, you know, she would have probably gotten up and followed him if it was something that he was passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's something that she's passionate about that's like a once in a lifetime opportunity. He's like, you're going, it doesn't matter between you and I, we'll figure that out, it'll be okay, but you're going. And yeah, it was so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a couple more things. I wrote flipped the truck. I said La La Land flipped the truck. And that is a reference to, there's this documentary I watched about the Dark Knight trilogy, and it's about how Chris Nolan doesn't like using CGI, and he likes using actual practicals mm-hmm. and doing everything for real. Mm-hmm. And there's some producer who's like, yeah, there's that scene in the Dark Knight when we flip an 18-wheeler. He's like, no other production in the world would have flipped the truck. We flipped that truck. And so they got the permits in New York or wherever they filmed Dark mm-hmm. Knight. I don't remember. I think it was New York. To actually flip a truck in the street using hydraulics and explosions. And like La La Land flipped the truck. Like one of the most impressive lighting shots is the shadow box during the dream epilogue
mm-hmm.
of when she's doing her audition. It's like just the silhouettes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the shadow box lighting go away. You have the actual lighting on them because it was really them. Could have easily been done with CGI or some sort of special effect, but it wasn't. I wrote down again the practical of the globe and the plane moving to Paris, and then the dancing in the star dome where the ground was wet and it shows those reflections.
Mm-hmm.
I have last shot of Ryan Gosling is so beautiful.
Yeah.
That shot of his face with the blue background is wow. I guess to finish, just to talk about it a little bit more, is I have trouble with this movie because I think I was really stubborn about it when it first came out in a very pretentious way, because I think everyone was like, oh, I love musicals, I love La La Land, and I was like, this is nowhere near as good as Singing in the Rain, was like my initial thought. And I don't think the two can really be compared as like my final thought, because it's pretty clear in this movie that they don't sing as well as the actors in Singing in the Rain. They don't dance as well. The choreography isn't as creative. The choreography isn't as difficult. But it does show the appreciation for the art and appreciation and the appropriation, I guess, of the original movies from 70 years ago. And I think that's really appreciated. And I think that, like, it's so impactful despite not having great dancing or great singing. I think that's part of the point. It was, I think, a very intentional decision to have Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, who can't really sing. Emma Stone kind of can, and Ryan mm-hmm. Gosling a little less.
Yeah.
But, like, it's still a charming movie, and it's still... And their dancing, too, is like, charming enough for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it just clearly shows through the link of the observatory in LA to Rebel Without a Cause, to her movie being compared to Rebel Without a Cause, tying that in. You had her Ingrid Bergman poster at the beginning of the movie on her wall. And then you show that again outside of her house in LA
mm-hmm.
when she's famous. And then you show a poster of her that looks like the Ingrid Bergman one, but it's her face on it. Mm-hmm. Like all those things, all those elements are there that like show the appreciation for movies before. And I think coming from a place in 2016 where I was like, this isn't a good movie, the dancing and singing wasn't good, there's truth to that a bit, but it is so impactful. It's such an impactful movie. you talked about you want the style of Sebastian. It's like I felt that way too about his watch. I remember for a while after watching this movie, I kid you not, I was 15 when I saw this. So this isn't that embarrassing, whatever. I remember, you know, they put their hands on their knees at the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
They both put their hands on their knees and then they move them slowly towards each other's leg and they hold hands. Mm-hmm. I remember for a while, sitting next to girls, I would put my hand on my knee just in case they had seen La La Land and like put their hand on their knee. You know? I think I legit did that. And like, that's kind of a stupid example, but it is a very impactful movie. I think I'll watch this in like 10 years and 20 years and be moved by it in the same way that I was today, in the mm-hmm. same way I was in 2016 when I was being stubborn about it. And I don't think you can say that about a lot of movies. I think this is the same type of movie that maybe they'll make a podcast about in 70 years and be like, hey, look at this old one that has some visual issues, but it's still pretty good. And, you know, wow.
Yeah, I will say, kind of going off what you said about the dancing, I think, you know, from what you said about Singing in the Rain, about, you know, in this episode and that episode, I think, you know, obviously you feel as if Singing in the Rain was this, like, monumental film that kind of propelled the musical genre forward and is a huge example of for musicals today, which, you know, I would say that it probably is. And I think when you say that, you know, La La Land, the dancing wasn't as good, and I feel like, yes, but while the dancing is a big part of La La Land, I don't think it is, like, the biggest thing, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Like,
I agree.
The pool party scene where the camera just hops in the pool and it pans around. It's not really focused. Like, yes, there are people dancing, but there's water on the camera, so you can't really see anything that clearly. All you can see is these people moving in unison, and it's this cool effect, you know? Really, the only important dancing is Maya and Sebastian. And it's like, it adds to the realness factor of it where, like I said about the romance, like, you would expect it to be a classic Hollywood romance and happy ending, blah, 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 but it's real and life gets in the way. And I think that the singing and dancing of those two characters as well, you know, while they're both artists, I mean, not everyone is a great dancer, not everyone's a good singer. And I think that kind of highlights that.
I think so. And you're right. It's not, the dancing is not the focus, but in those dance sequences, like someone in the crowd at the party, they so effortlessly solidify the mood of a dance sequence. And like, they showed the champagne bottles pouring and like the guy jumping into the pool, all those things, and the camera spinning around ending on fireworks. Like, they so, it's just like they get the mood even if the dancing's not there and the dancing's not highlighted. So yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Is that it?
That's all I got. I mean,
good movie. Good pick.
Really great movie. That ending scene is probably one of my favorite scenes of any movie, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes I just get on YouTube and I just watch that one scene by itself.
Yeah.
Just because it's really good. And is it, like, I mean, I've said it, I just said it like two seconds ago, but you expect this classic Hollywood romantic ending, and it sucks that you don't get that because that's what you want, but it's still like such a great ending because it's hard to describe the feelings of it, but it's just such a great ending.
It's necessary.
Yeah.
The characters sacrifice what they want for what they need. I think what they need truly is to, what Mia needed is to like make it as an actress, and what Sebastian needed was to own that club and to do what he wanted in terms of jazz, and to like block out naysayers who said they couldn't. And I think they needed that over each other, and that was that. And you want it. I don't wish for an alternate movie where they end up with each other. They gave us that a little bit in the dream sequence, you know, but I don't, that's not something I wish for. It's like they ended up where they were supposed to, and beautifully done. This is one of those movies where I watch and get depressed because it's like I'll never do something this good. Yeah. This is one of those. We've had a couple of those this semester, but Good pick. Should I announce the next one?
Sure. Go for it. Let's go.
Okay, so I was struggling because I knew I wanted to do a Spielberg. It seems necessary. I think one of the greatest directors to live. Maybe one of the great, probably the greatest director alive, next to Martin Scorsese, I think. I was picking between a couple of his movies, and I saw an Instagram post today that June 15th, the day that this episode, La La Land, is going to be released, is the 40th anniversary of Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark. So we will be picking above Jaws and Jurassic Park, which were my other two candidates, Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark from 1981, June 15th.
Isn't that a John Williams soundtrack as well?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think super cool because I know that we've talked about John Williams on this before, about just him being such a great composer and whatever the word is I'm forgetting. But yeah, actually looking forward to it. So that's good.
Yeah. I think it's rentable on Amazon, or that might be through Paramount, like Plus or whatever. It's like you can get a free trial and do it, but it's available to rent somewhere.
Cool.
If you haven't seen it. But yeah, awesome episode. Thank you guys for your support. We appreciate you. Really enjoyed this season. Sad to be coming to a close, but
Shut your mouth, bro. We still got 5 more. Come on.
All right, let's go.
You're right. All right, everyone. Yeah, this is a long episode. This may be our longest. I'm not sure.
By a couple of minutes, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. But we thank you so much again. You know, we keep saying it over and over, but super appreciate all the support. Continue to share. Continue to review. Continue to like our stuff on Instagram. Send us questions. Send us stuff. Whatever. But yeah, we'll see you next week with Michael's pick, Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And yep. I already have my film picked out for next week as well. So
awesome. I also have my last two picked out. So
boom. All right. We've already planned it. All right.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Peace.